Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Benjamin Wood, filling in for Roger McDonough. And today on the show, Republicans reverse course on reforming the Office of Congressional Ethics. Utah Governor Gary Herbert begins his third term. Backlash continues over the siting of homeless shelters in Salt Lake City. And advocates look to Donald Trump to help save the Bonneville Salt Flats. Those and other topics on the show today. Joining me this morning, Salt Lake Tribune, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief Thomas Burr is on the phone. Good morning, Tommy.
Good morning, Ben.
And in studio today, we have environment reporter Emma Penrod. Welcome, Emma.
Morning.
Also, Tribune government reporter Matt Piper is here. Matt, good morning.
Glad to be here.
And finally, Robert Gerke, now a columnist for the Tribune, is joining us. Robert, I'm excited to hear your take on the issues today.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
And listeners, you can join the conversation. What caught your attention from this past week's news? Put your comments and questions in the comment section at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Tommy Burr, let's start with some news out of Washington. The 115th Congress got off to a rocky start after a quick reversal on ethics investigations. What happened there?
You know, so this was an interesting move that really did happen behind closed doors. I don't know if it was a smoky back room necessarily, but kind of the same thing. The Republicans were meeting to kind of set the rules for the new Congress, as they usually do. And Congressman Bidlott from Virginia all of a sudden proposed an amendment to the rules that would essentially gut the Office of Congressional Ethics. So this was an office set up 2008 after several scandals in Congress to kind of take an independent look at ethics problems that occur in the House. You know, I think the listeners probably know that there's a House Ethics Committee, but that's made up of lawmakers. And as you can probably guess, lawmakers don't really like to police themselves. So this office was set up as kind of like, you know, a check and balance there, that it wouldn't be actual members of the House, judging their colleagues. It would be an independent group. So Congressman Goodlatte proposes this. It passes with all four of Utah's House members supporting it. The next day, after a backlash from the public, from Democrats, and the incoming President Donald Trump, Republicans decided to reverse themselves and say, well, let's study this one a little further. The question is whether, did they expect this backlash? Did they, think this would, pass? No one would notice. The day the office is still there, but I'm not sure for how long.
You mentioned in your article that some members of Utah's delegation have been the subject of ethics investigations. Do we know if those experiences played into these votes at all?
Not necessarily ethics investigations, but there have been some concerns. For example, Democrats have pointed out Congresswoman Mia Love, for example, had to repay taxpayers twice for a couple flights that she later said, shouldn't have been charged to taxpayers. But they weren't necessarily a subject of an actual investigation. However, there have been other members of the House, not from Utah, who were subject to this and felt it was really unfair because they couldn't, for example, have a lawyer at their side when being questioned or have all the evidence produced before this information became public. But if they were to gut the office, it would be back to the situation where you have four Republicans and four Democrats, who are actually investigating these things. And they could, if they end up, just voting 4-4, then the information is not made public and no one actually knows what happened in the investigation. And it's all just, swept underneath the rug, which is why we ended up in this situation before 2008, where finally, unless a prosecutor picked up on stuff or investigative journalists found it out, we never knew.
And you mentioned how President Trump had weighed in a tweet suggesting that Congress perhaps had bigger fish to fry. When might we see this issue revisited?
Yeah, it didn't really work for Mr. Trump's whole drain the swamp thing. When the first thing House Republicans are really doing is saying we don't want to drain the swamp, we want to add some more alligators. Again, this is something that all four of Utah's House members were talking about, how there does need to be reform with this organization, with this office. So the idea is within the next 8 months, I think, they're planning to, do some further study, and there might be some proposals that come back on the table.
And you also wrote about the Affordable Care Act this week, also known as Obamacare. What are we hearing from our Utah representatives as far as plans for that law?
Well, they plan to repeal it. They're not sure what they're going to replace it with yet, but they are very much planning within almost a month there could be legislation voted on that would essentially say, you know, this Obamacare thing is being gutted. What essentially we're looking at right now, though, is they may just want to take that Obama part out of it and leave some of the care part, because they like some of the popular things, like the idea that, you know, people aged up to 26 years old can stay on their parents' health insurance, that somebody with pre-existing condition cannot be turned down for health care. They want to get rid of the mandate that you have to buy insurance or you face a penalty of some sort. But again, it's all that very vague, up in the air. Well, we want to get rid of it. We're not sure what we're going to replace it with, and we like certain parts of it. It's very clear what they don't like about it is that Obama part.
Tommy, we'll come right back to you, but I want to hear Robert Gerke's take on this. Robert, certainly this wasn't the narrative that they were hoping to get from their first day back at work. What kind of tone does this set for the rest of the year?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Donald Trump came into office saying he's going to drain the swamp, but the swamp can be pretty prickly, I think, and sometimes it can resist a lot of efforts to reform it. These Republican members of Congress, they've had, as Tommy mentioned, some issues with this ethics office, but it does set a terrible tone, and it sort of sends the same signal that I think has frustrated voters for a long time, that Congress isn't going to police itself, and it's not necessarily doesn't want any accountability. They did back down on it, which I think shows that, you know, as Tommy mentioned, there was a barrage of phone calls and you know, upset constituents, and they did back away. But you know, that doesn't mean that it's going to survive through the end of the Congress. There are other ways that they can sort of take the legs out from under this ethics office. You know, and on the Obamacare repeal, I think with Republicans in control of both houses now of Congress and with a Republican president, it's more likely than ever that we'll see a repeal. But you're starting to hear from some of these from some constituents that they like what Obamacare's done for them. I mean, you've talked to, you know, Rand Paul came out the other day and said that, you know, particularly in his state of Kentucky, it's been beneficial for his constituents to have this, and he's not willing to repeal it without a replacement. And there's also this issue of, and Tommy mentioned that they want to get rid of the penalties and some of the taxes that come along with Obamacare. Well, that's fine, I guess, but then you've got this large hole that's blown into the budget of, I think it's about $350 million hole blown in the budget. And so they, you know, there's some resistance in that front as well. So, you know, the repeal is doable perhaps, and it's going to take some time, and it's got to do a few different moving pieces to it. But the replacement is the hard part, and they're still trying to figure out what that's going to look like.
If I can just jump in.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Tommy.
Thank you. It's that interesting part of politics here in Washington that you've got to love. So what may happen is Republicans will vote to repeal Obamacare, but essentially postpone any of the real changes until after the 2018 midterms, so they don't face any political backlash or people losing health care, but they can go out to their constituents and say, hey, we got rid of it. It'll just take a couple of months for it to actually happen. So they get the benefit of saying, yeah, no, we killed Obamacare. We did what you want us to do without having, you know, people lining up in front of cameras saying that they lost their health care.
And that also forces Democrats to come to the table to agree on the replacement portion of it.
Mm-hmm. A quick reminder to listeners, you can join this conversation with your calls at 801-355-8255. Tommy, before you go, I wanted to ask about the new Bears Ears National Monument in southern Utah. Utah's delegation was universally opposed to the monument. What kind of response should we expect from our federal representatives?
You know, I think we're going to see some legislation soon. I think it's already being written by some of our members of the delegation to overturn the Bears Ears Monument. It's unclear how the president-elect will handle this once in office. No president before has ever revoked, and it's not explicitly under the law. The president can get rid of a monument established by a previous president. But we could see some efforts there by Interior under the Trump administration to change what's going to happen with Bears Ears. In the meantime, I expect in the next few weeks we'll see some kind of legislation from Mike Lee's office or Congressman Chaffetz or Bishop's office to reverse what the president did.
And then the issue becomes getting that through the Congress. I think Democrats are going to would be resistant in the Senate to passing that legislation. There is also a possibility, and Tommy's discussed this before, of a rider exempting Utah from future monuments. And I think that's something that you'll probably see a push toward as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's Tommy Burr, the Salt Lake Tribune's Washington, D.C. bureau chief. Tommy, thanks for calling in this morning.
Cool. No, thanks, man.
Yeah, have a good morning. Staying on Bears ears for a minute longer, Matt Piper, you took a trip down to southern Utah after the president's announcement. How was the monument being received by local residents?
It depends where you went. If you went to Blanding or Monticello, the reception was very bad. The residents there see that as federal overreach, the latest in a long line of them. And, they congregated on Monticello's Main Street, which was shut down as state and local leaders spoke from the steps of the, or near the steps, I should say, of the county building about how Obama made his last tyrannical act and how this will embolden his opponents to undo the Antiquities Act, and that's what he'll be remembered for. If you go south to Bluff, which is a tourism-based town, which is near the reservation, it's received very well. They have been calling for years there to protect the archaeological sites that are very sacred to Native Americans and treasured by backpackers and outfitters. So it's a real stark divide. I think everyone down there has a take, and a strong take, but they vary widely.
You wrote this week about how monument supporters are saying that this isn't the end of preservation efforts. What are some of the concerns that remain even after the president's announcement?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a real trick. You say that this is a monument, and that kind of puts it on the map for some more casual tourists, maybe, who are already in the area to see arches or Canyonlands or Monument Valley. They may now be attracted to some very delicate sites that previously they would have never heard of. And these sites already have been more trafficked in recent years because of the rise of GPS and Google and blogs where people share, hey, you got to go check out this amazing ruin. It's almost untouched. It's preserved perfectly. And then, the next thing that happens, hundreds of backpackers show up there and ruin it. So that's a real concern, especially given that while they called for the monument designation in Bluff and, an intertribal coalition ultimately is sort of credited for it, There is some doubt that the new administration and a Republican-led Congress will devote the resources that are now needed to protect the increased to offset the impact of the increased traffic there.
Robert, there's not a lot of love for Bears Ears among Utah's state leaders. Mm-hmm. We're hearing calls to reverse the monument. Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes is talking about a lawsuit. How would you peg the chances for success of those efforts?
Well, I mean, I think the chances of success for a lawsuit are pretty much slim and none. I mean, these monuments have been litigated and challenged in court since the first monument in 1906, and every time the courts have upheld the president's authority to designate the monuments. The question of whether Trump can reverse the monument is an open one. He certainly can change the boundaries. That's been done before in the past. And then the legislative attack that you're going to see on it is going to be either passing the PLI, which the Public Lands Initiative that Rob Bishop and Jason Chaffetz have, they would basically go in and change the designation through that act. Bishop says that has a good chance of passing in the coming year. I think it's maybe a little bit less likely that they can get that through the Senate without some, again, resistance from Democrats. And then the push to just sort of undo the monument through a separate piece of legislation, I think, is probably a little less likely than getting the PLI passed. So right now, I mean, the other issue, the other thing that's in play, and Matt alluded to this, is that there's a management plan that has to be put together by the new administration that will actually, lay out and detail and specify how this land can be used and how it's going to be protected. And, you know, if the Trump administration wants to drag its feet on that or wants to have make it lenient and permissive in terms of what uses are there, that's also something that they can do when they're creating that management plan. The designation itself is not very specific in terms of what will and won't be allowed inside the monument. And so there's a lot of latitude for the new administration when they're defining how that land is going to be protected and used to shape it the way they want it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break. Ahead on the show, we'll be talking about Utah's air quality as well as efforts to preserve the Bonneville Salt Flats. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Benjamin Wood, filling in for Roger McDonough, and joined for the remainder of this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Emma Penrod and Matt Piper, and by columnist Robert Gerke. We're digging into this past week's news, and you can join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or calling us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Matt Piper, you've covered a series of meetings this week in which Salt Lake City residents have had a chance to respond to the recently announced locations for new homeless shelters. What's the mood at those meetings been like?
The mood Tuesday night at the City Council meeting's public input session was one of frustration. They had 150 people there. The room only, the council chambers only sits 100. So about 50 waited across the hall and watched, I think, on some sort of TV they had set up there. Almost every single one of them lives near the 653 East Simpson Avenue site in Sugar House, and almost every single one of them felt like they had been excluded from the public input process. While the city says, you know, they were included in the selection of the criteria that ultimately guided the sites that they chose, that doesn't really mean anything if you woke up that day having not paid a whole lot of attention to it to find out that there's going to be a homeless shelter a stone's throw from your house that maybe you put your life savings into. City leaders listened patiently. They did so again the following night at the Sugar House Community Council, where there was a little bit more of a Q&A type session. And then last night, Ballpark Community Council heard from the mayor and other city leaders again, and it was much more subdued. Everyone there seems to have had the expectation that they would get a homeless shelter, and there were a couple of comments to the effect that Sugar House should maybe suck it up and do their part, as Ballpark feels it has done previously and is happy to do again. So it remains a controversial issue, though, that the city did not court public opinion about a list of finalists, and it seems now that they are doing so. Whether or not they can actually walk back any of these sites remains to be seen.
If one or more of the sites were to be walked back, eliminated, what would that mean for the overall plans for the homeless shelters?
Well, I mean, they spent a lot of time. They spent 2 years coming up with this model. And, you know, up until September, they were going to do two sites with 250 beds. And the city council said that's going to have too big of an impact on the affected communities. And the whole point of the scattered site model is that with smaller populations, you can provide better services. And, you know, you can also sort of split populations that might conflict with each other and all kinds of things that they thought about through this process. And ultimately, they got the mayor and county to sign off on that. And they set about trying to find now four sites instead of two with very little time. But they did so because they did so knowing that, and they did so for what they thought were good reasons. And you know, Councilwoman Lisa Adams, whose district includes 653 East Simpson, she has since proposed just cutting that site and not adding another site and going down to three. And she doesn't have any buy-in on that, as far as I can tell from any other council members. They all say the whole point of this was to have four. We don't want a larger shelter somewhere, which obviously would then be received poorly by whatever community gets that. and they want to move forward with the four sites that the city has said that they all agreed upon at one point.
Well, and I think you've touched on this in your articles, but there's a bit of an east-west issue here with the Simpson Avenue site being essentially the only east side site. Is that correct?
Yeah. Councilman Andrew Johnston made that point that if you eliminate the Simpson Avenue site, then you have nothing east of 200 East. I guess really all of those are east side Salt Lake City, depending on where you draw the distinction.
Is it
Highway 15
or
is
it
state west Highway 15?
Yeah. But I think that there's some real sore feelings among some residents west of State Street that these shelters are not near. The claim you often hear is the homes of the council members and the city administration, and there may be something to that. Obviously, the value of the surrounding properties is a serious consideration for the city. Whether that's a politically correct thing for them to say, if you put a shelter in Yalecrest, has a bigger impact on the city's bottom line than it does if you do it in a commercial area out west.
You also wrote about the cost of these sites. Talk a little bit about the cost of the Simpson Avenue site. It took up the bulk of the funding the city had, correct?
Yeah. So what I've been told is that they wanted a site that they thought would be specifically for families. Now, this was never written into what was going to be a resolution that they voted on. It still has yet to be determined whether that site will be a family shelter. But at that site, they wanted it first. They wanted it to be away from the other three sites, and they wanted it to be in a neighborhood where those families could potentially even join someday. And they had to pay a little bit more to get that. And in this case, they ended up paying $7 million of a little less than $12 million that the city council had set aside for this purpose. So that's a little bit of, there may be a little bit of sticker shock involved with that. But the city says that was the best that they could do with that accelerated timeline and given the scarcity of properties that met those criteria.
Robert Gerke, Mayor Biskupski has been in office for about a year now. How does this issue play into her burgeoning political legacy?
Well, I think we've seen a pattern now from the mayor's office that they do a pretty poor job of communicating their message at the outset and then try to do damage control. That's kind of what they're facing now. I mean, they didn't explain to the public that they had a different concept for these shelters, and now they're going back when they're facing this backlash and this outcry, trying to talk people down. It would have been a lot easier for them to do the messaging beforehand, but they tend to not think strategically. They act first and then do damage control later. We saw it when she went in and cleaned house and fired everybody from, one of her first acts as mayor. And we've seen it with time and again since then. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, I guess. They could have gone out and had public hearings and explained to people what they were trying to do. And probably, as Matt mentioned, when you have the ballpark community kind of willing to take one for the team, you might have had a little bit more buy-in from the Sugar House community if they had understood at the outset what this was going to be. The Sugar House site is not a bad site. It's close to the LDS Family Services. It's close to there's a Catholic church over there. That these are the service providers that these people are going to need when they're trying to get back on their feet. But one of the most shocking things I think about the Sugar House site was that the daycare that it's going to be displacing didn't even know that it was under consideration for being displaced. And so they've gone about it poorly, and now they're trying to clean up the mess that they've made.
With it being so early in her term, would you assume that there is time to correct some of those steps and looking ahead to her next election?
Well, I mean, if they've shown any inclination toward fixing any of the problems that they have, but they seem to just keep compounding them, she's got time. She's got 3 years to try to right the ship. But, you know, if they don't do anything to, you know, steer the ship away from the rocks or to fix any of the problems that they've got, they're going to keep, you know, they're going to keep running into the same problem over and over. And she would probably end up being a one-term mayor at that point. I think there's already talk of, and Matt can probably talk a little bit more about this, but challengers coming that are already lining up to, you know, they see her as being vulnerable and she's, you know, I think she's in some real trouble.
Okay. Well, Emma Penrod, thanks for being patient. You wrote recently about an effort to preserve the Bonneville Salt Flats. What do advocates have in mind?
Yeah, so failing to have convinced the BLM to take action itself, the BLM is in charge of managing the salt flats. Some interested parties, primarily land speed racers, have, you know, banded together in this Save the Salt Coalition and have decided to take this to the federal government and ask Congress to pass a law that will mandate that the BLM restore the Bonneville salt flats to 1960s era's conditions. And my understanding is there's probably would be some leeway as to how they would do that, but it would give them a deadline and say, you must do this. So that being the case, they were originally going to introduce this legislation in September about, they thought, fallish, you know, and then the election happened. And that seemed like it may not have such a good shot with all the turmoil that was involved there. So, and then President Trump was elected. So their thoughts were, maybe we will do better under Trump than we did under Obama, or that they could have done under Obama. My understanding is that they say they have talked to somebody in the administration, that this person has told them that, yes, the administration would be supportive of this kind of legislation, would want to help to preserve the salt flats, but they will not identify who that person is, and so we haven't been able to confirm who or whether they have talked to somebody in the transition team or in the administration.
You've covered the state of the salt flats throughout the year. What's happening to them, and what would it take to restore them to their former glory?
Is it them?
Is it an it? I never know if it's plural or singular for the salt flats. Them.
Flat, yeah, it's not entirely clear what's happening out there. There is research ongoing. Some preliminary research that looked at aerial photography found that although there are fluctuations seasonally and between various years, there has been a gradual inclination toward smaller salt flats, that the area is decreasing and has over the last 30 years. That's not entirely sure why that's happening. There's a bunch of theories that have been thrown out, but the research isn't there, surprisingly. To a lot of people, you might think there would be a lot of research done on the salt flats, but it's relatively limited. So that has been the BLM's position. The BLM's position is we need to wait until the research tells us what's really going on here so that we can come up with an action plan that will be effective rather than rushing into things and potentially causing even more damage, who knows. Whereas the Save the Salt Coalition is saying, look at the rate that this has been declining over the last 30 years. It's still getting worse. Maybe if we don't act now, we're going to lose it and we may not be able to bring it back. So those are kind of the two, you know, dueling viewpoints on this at this point.
Mm-hmm. We're also lungs deep in inversion season right now. How has air quality been lately and what's headed our way?
Well, right now, I mean, we've had the succession of storms we've had over the last week has helped to clean things up a little bit. Prior to that was not so good, as everyone noticed, I'm sure. I've heard it might be coming back a little today. I haven't had a chance to check myself, but, you know, that's what happens. You have your stagnant air conditions, your not stormy air, the weather that we all like to think of as being nice weather is when you're going to get inversions and start building up the pollution again.
You had written recently about an issue with our air quality monitors. What happened there, and are there any updates?
Yeah, so that monitor's back online, but what happened was they had a monitor at the beginning of that inversion over the last week that was evidently replaced, and then the new monitor failed, That was in Weber in Ogden. So if you were from Weber County and you wanted to go check on your air conditions, you open up the air quality monitors online, and you know, usually they'll show you, is it green, is it, you know, red, whatever. And if you went to Weber's page, it just said it was not available. In the past, when monitors have failed, sometimes they say they're not available. Other times they just read zero and say there's a, you know, green air. Sometimes they, you know.
Skull and crossbones.
I mean, I don't know that I've ever seen a skull and crossbones up there, but it's they have a situation with about half of the air monitors in the state being older than they ought to be. Like any technology, like your phone, like your computer, eventually it stops working. And these are only supposed to last a certain amount of time. Half of the ones in the state right now are over that age, and the state is running out of spare parts and replacements to keep them running, so these failures are, you know, continuing to happen.
Mm-hmm. Robert Gerke, we're a couple weeks out from the legislative session. Should we expect any air quality legislation this year?
Well, there's going to be a lot of legislation introduced. Your question is going to be what's going to pass. I mean, every year, as Emma notes, that we get these big inversions rolling in right at the beginning of the session, and by the middle of the session, it rolls out and legislature stops paying attention to it. The air monitoring thing that she mentioned is something that they've been trying to get funding for the last couple of years. I believe the governor proposed it last year, and the legislature had supported it, but then at the last minute, the funding got pulled for it. So there will be legislation again. I suspect Representative Handy's going to sponsor legislation to retrofit buses. There's going to be a question of whether they should extend the electric vehicle tax credit that's going to expire this year. And the bottom line is this is something that the public has you know, been outspoken about, and the legislature has taken baby steps along the way, I guess, to some degree. But there's still a sort of a lack of satisfaction. No matter how many times the governor and the legislature tells people that the air quality is getting better, when their kids have to stay in from school, they don't consider that improvement, or at least not enough improvement. So there's going to be some pressure on them to do something again this year. And whether or not they do, I guess, it probably depends largely on whether we get big inversions in January and February and whether they respond to that.
Well, Robert, we'll have you talk more about the session after another quick break. Listeners, we'd love to get your thoughts on this or anything else in the local news. Call us at 801-355-TALK with your questions. We can take them live on the air, or you can leave them for us to discuss. You can also comment at sltrib.com. This is Behind the Headlines on KCBW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Benjamin Wood, filling in for Roger McDonough. I'm joined in studio this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Emma Penrod, Matt Piper, and Robert Gerke. Robert, you had the opportunity to attend Governor Herbert's inauguration ceremony this week. Any noteworthy moments?
No, not really. These inaugurals are mostly ceremony, and so as the last several have been, it was largely ceremonial. The governor talked a lot about Utah spirit and sort of the perseverance that Utahns have shown over the centuries. I mean, or century, I guess. Centuries is an overstatement, but he didn't really sort of offer his concept or his vision for what lies ahead. I think we'll see that laid out in more detail when he gives his State of the State address in a few weeks. And also it was probably worth noting that this was entirely ceremonial. They'd actually all been sworn into office a couple days prior, because under the law they have to be sworn in on the first Monday of the year, and that was a holiday. So they did a private ceremony. Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, they had a judge come down to his home, and he was sworn in a sweater. And then they'd had the larger event with the Tabernacle Choir, which was quite lovely, as they perform in the Capitol Rotunda. And it was largely for show, and we'll get some idea of what the governor wants to do, presumably when he gives a State of the State in a couple weeks.
In your debut column for the Salt Lake Tribune, you suggested that a third and ostensibly final term gives Herbert the ability to maybe flex some political muscle in ways he hasn't before. What would that look like if he did?
Well, I don't know if we know what it would look like because we haven't really seen it in the years that he's been in office. He has sort of an unfettered free rein to do what he wants to do. I mean, if he's not going to have to run again, if he's not going to, he's won his election easily by, I think, 38 points. And so he does have this enormous reservoir of capital that he can use if he wants to use it. But it's you ask him where he sees himself taking the state in this term, and he doesn't really give you much in the way of detail. So, there are things that he could do, and as I pointed out in the column, there are things that the public in public opinion surveys have indicated that they want, and probably the one that's most important or most. In the public's view, is this Utah Schools Now initiative that our Schools Now initiative? I'm sorry,
our yes,
yeah. That some of the business leaders, Scott Anderson and others, have been pushing for, and that is to increase the income tax a little bit to give schools an infusion of money, because as we've heard for years and years and years, Utah's got the lowest per pupil spending in the country, and it's going to take decades to grow our way out of that if that's what he wants to do. The governor's concerned about that potentially, if you have a tax increase, he's against tax increases on principle, although he's done it in the past. He's concerned that if you increase the income tax, it's going to hurt the economy. There's some room for him to maneuver. There's public support for this. He can propose a smaller tax increase if he wants to do that. He can propose some other tweaks to the tax code to try to get this money in there. But again, it's going to take some leadership from the governor. And as I mentioned in the column, he has, in the past, been more of a manager than a leader.
The organizers of Our Schools Now recently met with the Tribune's editorial board. I had a chance to be in the room, and there was kind of this open question about what role Governor Herbert would play, whether he would oppose it from a distance or more aggressively be involved in defeating it. Do you have any sense of how actively he might work against Our Schools Now?
That's actually a good question, because while he has traditionally opposed tax increases, and while he specifically has opposed tax increases to the income, an increase to the income tax to fund education in the past, I think there's support building for this, and it's harder for him to, despite not having to run again, it's going to be harder for him to sort of face down this public support for this, particularly when it's coming from the business community. I would anticipate, again, I don't have a crystal ball on this one, I guess, but I would anticipate that he'll probably stay on the sidelines, at least at first. And then perhaps if there's a compromise solution that might, split the baby, so to speak, then you might see him come in and support that at the end of the legislative session.
Okay. What any other topics ahead of the legislature that you have your eye on?
Well, it's interesting because when you have this transition going on in Washington, the new Trump administration, it's kind of hard to. One of the big issues last year, for example, was medical marijuana, and we have a new attorney general coming into the Trump administration, who has been an opponent of legalized medical marijuana. And so, whereas the Obama administration and their attorney general has sort of been content to look the other way, we don't know if that's going to happen this year. So I suspect on an issue like that, we're going to have to wait and see, and we probably won't see much legislation passed this year on that. Another one that's sort of along those same lines, we're going to see some public land stuff probably, but Medicaid reform, which has been a top issue for the last couple of years, as we talked about earlier, we don't know if we're going to have a repeal and replace, and if we're going to what it's going to be replaced with, and so you're probably not going to see any. My point is those. Some of those big issues from years past probably won't be big issues this year. I think the education funding is going to be a big one. I think there's a good likelihood that we'll probably see a push for some liquor reform that actually might be successful this year. There's Jerry Stevenson's already making noise about taking down the Zion Curtain. The tourism industry's been pushing for some of this, some other sort of minor tweaks, really. And I think there's some momentum for that. Hate crimes could be an issue. There was a bill that almost passed last year before the LDS Church sort of intervened and cut the legs out from under that one. And there's talk of potentially trying to repeal the death penalty again. It's interesting because over in the Senate, you've got this push to repeal the death penalty. Over in the House, you've got Paul Rey, who's trying to accelerate the death penalty to make sure that it's, you know, happens quicker. So you've got these two sort of on a collision course. And so I think there'll be some discussion of that in the upcoming session as well. And then, as we mentioned, air quality is going to be, I think, especially early in the session, a major issue.
You mentioned the Zion Curtain, and one of your final articles in your past life as a reporter dealt with Representative Thurston's proposal to drop the blood alcohol limit for DUIs to 0.05. Could we maybe see that as part of a bundle that brings the Zion Curtain down?
Well, there's some talk of that, that if you're going to take down the Zion Curtain, that you're going to have to give anti-drinking advocates a win as well. And that's how... In years past, that's how we've seen liquor reform take place. It's sort of been two steps forward and one step back. You got to kind of make these compromises. That could be a piece of it. And I talked to Scott Beck from the tourism industry, and he sort of suggested that could be potentially a piece of it. It would be an interesting move for Utah because we would be the first state in the country to go to 0.05. Which is about, I think, for an average male, about 3 drinks an hour. Female could be 2 drinks in an hour. It would be a little bit problematic for law enforcement because it's hard to tell if somebody's at a 0.05. You know, you kind of have to still enforce it the same way. And then see where the breathalyzer comes back, but it is going to be on the table, and I think it will be part of this cocktail of liquor policy that the legislature will be dealing with when they come back into session.
And one last question on the legislative session: there's continuing talk about Utah's war on porn. What's in store on that subject this year?
Yeah, I mean, Senator Wyler sponsored the public health, the resolution that declared it a public health crisis last year. This year he's looking at getting some funding so libraries can put filters on the computers. Matt Cannon reported this last week that he is looking at making it the law in Utah that individuals can sue porn companies for damages resulting from porn addiction and the like. It's sort of a weird bill because presumably if you could make the argument that there were damages that you could sue them now, you know, so I'm not exactly sure what the intent of the bill is. It also, pornography is, according to the Supreme Court, a protected speech under the First Amendment. And so, you could maybe sue over obscenity rather than pornography, but there's a legal distinction between the two. And I think you would probably have a hard time proving a case where there's a, where, again, pornography is protected as a free speech. But it will be discussed. It probably will get some national attention and draw some national headlines, which I know Senator
perhaps another
Wyler
penthouse
was,
cover for the governor.
Yeah, perhaps that. And so it'll be in the mix. And the other thing is that most of the legislators are sort of loath to oppose these because it's popular with their constituents. Whether or not they actually do anything, it looks good, I guess.
Well, certainly a lot to watch as the legislature gets up and running, and look for that coverage in the Salt Lake Tribune. Our hour has gone by quickly, and we've come to our final segment of the show, the Underplayed Stories of the Week, where we look at important and meaningful stories that maybe flew under the public radar. Emma Penrod, why don't we begin with you? Your thoughts on an underplayed story this week?
Sure. It may be early to decide whether or not this is underplayed or not, but there's a story that just went live this morning about a landowner outside Bluff who has blocked a road that goes to a popular recreation area that is now part of the Bears Ears National Monument. There's no trespassing sign. It's locked. The CITLA has apparently... who sold the land originally, has apparently told the landowner that they should probably unlock the gate on the road. But local officials are like, well, we don't know really. Is that a county road? Is it a private road? We're not sure. And so it's locked. So interesting story there. Just went live. You can check it out.
Excellent. Well, backpackers, if you're heading to Bears Ears, you might want to think about the scenic route, I guess. Matt Piper, your underplayed story this week.
Yeah, so I'm a recovering sports writer, and I'm not really a fan of anything, but I'm kind of a dedicated observer of Real Salt Lake. And they just acquired their newest, they call it a number 10 in soccer, even though the player often does not wear number 10. That's just a soccer thing. It's the playmaker, an attacking midfielder. He is a 22-year-old Slovakian who is in the youth system for Manchester City. He has kind of a crazy haircut. And apparently, you pronounce his name like this. Just wait for this. I've got it queued up here.
Albert Rusnak.
So how can you not enjoy that?
Can you attempt to reproduce that with your voice?
Albert Rusnak.
Well done.
Good, good. All right, well, a new player to watch at Real Salt Lake. And Robert Gerke, your pick this week.
Well, this is something that happens every single year, and it never really gets the attention it deserves. But this is a big, big one, so I guess it's Ben Wood's birthday today. It's his 30th birthday, and so we want to wish him happy
birthday. Robert
Gerke
will never be on the show again.
And that is definitely an underplayed story, so happy birthday, Ben.
A reluctant thank you.
Should we sing?
I mean, we do have time to fill, but I don't think we should subject the listeners to that. Lastly, my selection for an underplayed story. This went live this morning. It's by Lee Davidson, and it's about Utah's payday loan industry. A couple quick notes from the story there. The average interest rate for Utah payday lenders is roughly double that of 1960s mafia loans. And there are more payday loan locations in Utah than the number of Subways, McDonald's, Burger King's, and Wendy's restaurants combined. So interesting story there that just went live on sltrib.com while we were speaking. And as something to look forward to on Monday, the Tribune is hosting a special event at the Tower Theater where our movie critic Sean Means will be sitting down with Trevor. Oh, dear. It's Groth, I believe. Yes, Trevor Groth, the programmer for the Sundance Film Festival. They'll be talking this year's festival slate and tips and tricks for locals looking to attend. Information is available on Facebook and at sltrib.com. That's Monday at the Tower Theater. Well, to finish up the show today, thanks to my guests for joining us. Emma Penrod, thank you for joining us. Matt, I guess we'll go one at a time. Emma, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
And Robert Gerke, our new columnist, thank you for opining for us today.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
That's it for today's edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Tribune's Emily Means. I'm Benjamin Wood, filling in again for Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend, everybody.